Well, hello to everyone. Very encouraging over in St. Petersburg to have that kind of response. There was a little bit of competition with the president coming in and dominating the traffic patterns over there in Largo, not far away from where we had our church service. So that happens sometimes. But regardless, a nice response. Well, let me ask you, what is it that you live for? I think we live for a number of different things. It's interesting to note what values certain famous people have placed on aspects of life. Sometimes it's quite selfish. For some, it has been nothing more than the self, the ego. When Muhammad Ali was asked, who is the greatest? He says, well, I'm the greatest. And he says, not only am I the greatest, I was saying that back before I was. There was a world champion chess player, Bobby Fischer, who must have had a huge ego himself to say, when he was asked, what do you live for? He says, I live for the moment when I break a man's ego in a chess game. For some, it's materialism. When Alexander the Great was crying, somebody asked Alexander, what's wrong? He said, I have nothing left to conquer. He could have conquered himself, I suppose, but nothing physical. Queen Elizabeth I, just before she died, she was sad. And she said on her deathbed, all of these possessions I have, but for a moment. There was an early winner of the New York State Lottery, a janitor who won $5 million, one of the first winners. And people asked him, well, what are you going to do with the money? Are you going to help your relatives? Are you going to help the United Way, donate to other causes, or so forth? And he says, I'm going to use the money to win the New Jersey State Lottery. That was his answer. It's just so sad to be so close to being in a position to helping make a difference for other people and letting that opportunity slip through one's fingers. There was a man, though, that was very different. He lived in the Middle East. We don't know a whole lot about him, but he was unusual, and he was dedicated to God and God's principles. He lived in the Middle East. He might have even been a pharaoh, a magistrate, a king, somebody with a lot of authority and with tremendous wealth, and his name was Job. We don't know that much about Job, but he was unusual in that he lived a righteous life. In fact, Satan the devil said, I can't find anything wrong with this person. It was only by God's help that God was able to enabling Job to ultimately have a deeper assessment of himself and how he needed to even grow far more than what he had already. But in one sense, Job was a righteous man that did a great deal of good for the people around him. And I'd like for us to take a look at that over in the book of Job, chapter 29. Job 29, verse 12. Job 29, verse 12, first of all. 29, verse 12. Here he's made the statement, recollecting all the things that he had done when he was in his prime, when he was healthy, before he was sick. He said, for I assisted the poor in their need, and the orphans who required help. And in verse 14, everything that I did was honest. I'm reading from the New Living Translation. I wouldn't use it for establishment of doctrine, but it reads a little more easily. He says, everything that I did was honest. Righteousness covered me like a robe, and I wore justice like a turban. I served as the eyes for the blind and feet for the lame. I was a father to the poor, and I assisted strangers who needed help. I broke the jaws of godless oppressors and plucked up their victims from their teeth. An incredible observations about his earlier activities. In verse 20, new honors were constantly bestowed on me. My strength was continually renewed. Everyone listened to my advice. They were silent as they waited for me to speak. And after I spoke, they had nothing to add, for my counsel satisfied them. They longed for me to speak as people long for rain. They drank my words like a refreshing spring rain. When they were discouraged, I smiled at them. My look of approval was precious to them. Like a chief, I told them what to do. I lived like a king among his troops, and I comforted those who mourned. It seemed as if people were very much on the minds of this person. He had the authority to make things better. He had the money to help out. He was well known and apparently well appreciated for his efforts. In addition to everything that we read, I'd like for us now to focus on verse 13. Verse 13, same chapter. He said, I helped those without hope, and they blessed me, and I caused the widows' hearts to sing for joy. He caused the widows' hearts to sing for joy. Historically, widows and disadvantaged people have been overlooked in many societies. And in this society, to some extent, yes, there are government safety nets that do exist for various people. But we live in a society that's increasingly selfish. And in many parts of the world, it's like it has always been. There's never been any help for those in need. If we think back to the introduction about causing the heart's widows to sing for joy. Alexander the Great didn't have that on his mind. Muhammad Ali didn't say that. Elizabeth I didn't say that. The person after the New Jersey State Lottery, that wasn't on his radar screen at all. So many people ignore these situations. But beyond that, those that are sensitive to them are under the gun because it costs more to live, takes more time to work, there are many more responsibilities, other people leaning on those that are able to keep it together, so to speak. And so, even with those that do care, they have less discretionary time. And that can mean that others could miss out. But I'd like to address this subject, the widow's hearts singing for joy. I think, at the outset, I'll state, the United States of America could learn a lot from the good example set in this congregation. And for that, I would like to praise where praise is appropriate. But what is it that you and I can do to cause the widow's hearts to sing for joy? I think it's worth taking the time first to understand the condition that many are in, and then consider what it is that we realistically can do to cause the widow's hearts to sing for joy. Perhaps there's nothing more important than that in life. And yet so often, at least in society, that can be omitted. I'd like for us to turn over to James chapter 1 and verse 27. James 1 and verse 27. I like the way this reads in the King James Version. And it may be a scripture familiar to many. James chapter 1, verse 7. James, the brother of Jesus Christ, as far as we know, and one who could say a lot in few words. He says in verse 27, pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this, to visit the fatherless and the widows in their affliction, and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. And I think the subject of widowhood is broad enough that I'd like to focus on that for this sermon and not make it too large. But it certainly encompasses many other aspects, fatherless and others, that certainly deserve attention here at church. But it says, widows in their affliction. Well, what does the Bible mean by affliction? And I have a list of things that certainly are encapsulated by that concept. This will not apply to every person, but many of these things are overly familiar. So many widows, and maybe less here, but certainly around the world, and it's been true for centuries, many widows have had to understandably worry about hospital bills, shopping, eye problems, circulatory problems, bladder issues, distant relatives or no relatives or problems with relatives, worrying about that, car problems, house repairs, money, mobility, You know, if somebody falls, that could change everything. It could change. It could turn somebody from independence to dependence. It could be a very scary situation. Needing car rides, issue of housing, prescriptions, untrusting phone solicitors, security, sufficiency, loneliness. For some, there are feelings of guilt. I could have done more. I didn't think that our marriage would be so short. Whatever. Feeling of helplessness sometimes for some people. Sleeplessness. Almost all the elderly that I have met have said some of these things from time to time. What I hear them also saying, and I think you do too, is, well, you know, we want to enjoy life. We want to share life with people. We want to continue to live like we always have, be able to have access to the things that are important, and to be with our church family, and to be able to connect on different levels with the people in society, and why not? Apparently, Job was able to evaporate a lot of those worries, a lot of those fears, because he had the authority, he had the money, he had the vision, the drive, and the resources, the people to help make that happen. Wherever he was, and it was possibly in Egypt, but wherever he was, people that were in a potential situation where they could have been at disadvantage apparently had security. They had places to live. They didn't worry about food. They didn't worry about the basics. And that freed them up. That freed them up for a life of happiness. Job caused the widows' hearts to sing for joy. If he were alive today, he would be concerned with addressing the various and many manifold needs of elderly people. That's the way he was. I can remember, not when I was 23 years of age, I had a new job with where I ended up visiting certain nursing homes, and I remember meeting a 95-year-old woman, and I was trying to be cheerful, and I said, you know, when I asked how old she was, 95, I said, well, I hope to be 95 someday. Now, I was thinking, you know, if I get to live to be that old, then that means I will have probably accumulated a lot of travel, a lot of experiences, read, done things, met people, and so forth. And, you know, with all things being equal, I think that would be very attractive even now. But when I said that to her, I would like to be 95 one day, she got very corrective and angry, and she says, don't you ever hope for such a thing. She was dependent. She was stuck. She felt her life was over. She was miserable. She didn't know anybody. She didn't like her circumstances. She didn't know any way to do anything about it. She had no authority, no money, nothing. In her mind, her life was over. And so my effort to encourage her was like a lead balloon. It's nice when we can see people of all ages and elderly people continue to be productive, because that's what all of us would want at that age. In 1980, Ronald Reagan was on the campaign trail for president, and he met with a number of senior citizens, and one person said, well, what do you propose to do for the senior citizens? And he thought for a minute. He says, oh, he says, well, I'm one of you. It just occurred to him. He was 70 years of age at that point. I think many will remember, I've heard about his 1984 debate with Walter Mondale, when he was asked a loaded question by the moderator. Basically, are you too old to handle the rigors of being president? And of course, he came back with no. And furthermore, I will not make age an issue of this campaign. I am not going to exploit, he's looking at Walter Mondale, his opponent, who was maybe 60 years of age. He says, I will not make age an issue of this campaign. I'm not going to exploit, for political purposes, my opponent's youth and inexperience. To me, that was classic. Classic. People who've made an indelible positive mark on the world, even all the way through their 90s, include Arthur Rubinstein, Pablo Casals, a great celloist, Bob Hope, George Burns, Winston Churchill, Bernard Baruch, Now, Bernard Baruch was assisting and advising presidents all through his 80s. And he said that old age was whatever was 15 years older than what he was at the present time. So when he was 91, then he figured a person this old has to be at least 106. So that's the way he thought of it. You can add to that list Charlie Chaplin and Fred Astaire, who almost made it to 90. It's a beautiful thing when older people retain their talents and accumulated wisdom. I love it with this one story. One senior citizen was 70 years old working for the city of New York, and he was laid off. And he claimed it was age discrimination. And so he decided to sue for $1 million. And what did he do? He hired an attorney who was 89 years old. And they won in court. $1 million. I thought that was poetic justice. Now, nobody lives forever, but time can creep up on people. I'll never forget Lillian Sirks when she had a 90th. People threw a party for her when she reached 90. And at the Olive Garden, she's laughing and looking at me, and she says, 90 years old? I never thought that would ever happen. How did this creep up on me? But it can happen. But sometimes widowhood can come to somebody when they're very young. It all plays out differently for different people. I'll read one letter that a person wrote. He said, "We were in a traffic accident. I survived, but my husband did not." She says, I couldn't believe it. I cried for 4 days afterward. The days up until the funeral were a daze for me. Even though I received leave time from work, I couldn't think. I couldn't move. I just sat there outside on my patio, and I was oblivious to the change of color of the leaves or the crossing the sun every day until nighttime. She said, "Were it not for others, I would have sat out in the weather until the snows came and froze me over." There's a saying that, she goes on to say, a saying out there that time heals all wounds. People told me later, quote, "Someday you'll meet somebody new." I didn't believe it. I didn't think that I would have any tears left to cry with. I didn't want to date. It terrified me. I thought, what if I meet somebody wonderful and then that person dies? I can't take it. I know I won't be able to handle it. I can't go that far. And she said, and I didn't want pity, but I didn't want people to think I was odd. And I felt invisible, and I didn't feel like I fit in. Now, in the family of God, people should always fit in. But this is not easy. It's not often discussed. We're at the point where in this country alone, almost 300,000 married men become widowers every year. And among women, it's over double that. 650,000 people a year become widows. It appears by many statistical studies that the older people seem to cope with that better than those that are younger. But some psychologists argue that 10% at any age, they grieve and they never, ever come out of that. Now, grieving can be appropriate. If we live on long enough, getting older will mean taking on more difficulties. There was one widow who was in her 90s, mother of somebody that I got to know. And this widow in Chicago lived there. She was getting her groceries, you know, in the middle of January. It'd be bitter cold. She had to make sure she didn't slip on the snow and ice. And she said to one of her colleagues, she says, "Well, old age is not for sissies. It's not for sissies." I've heard that even repeated down here. But a widow does not have to be 120 years of age to be in affliction. Affliction can mean being burdened with worries and not having relationships. And for people that are in those situations, that is hard. I think the church and I think this congregation does a lot to alleviate that. But consider this. There was a Metropolitan Life study done years ago on stress study. And they were able to evaluate the impact of stress. the various setbacks or difficulties. For example, if somebody lost a job, that would be equivalent of about 50 points of stress. Moving was a huge stressor. Changing jobs, changing school areas, you know, for children and so forth. Uncertainties involved. Is where I'm going to be less expensive, more expensive than where I'm at now, and so forth. 60 points, I believe, was assigned to that. And, you know, if you broke a leg, that might be 10 points of stress. If, you know, you bounced a check, it might be 3 points. But losing a mate was 100 points. That was huge. 100 points in a good relationship. Now, they made the assessment that a maximum, if you added loss of a job, let's say, and moving and loss of a mate, that'd be 100 points plus 50 plus 60. You'd have about 210 points. And 300 points was death. Nobody could sustain so much stress that they could absorb emotional hits from every setback known to man. So when you consider that, what are hospital bills? Is that maybe 60 points? Maybe shopping hassles, credit card issues, 15 points, eye problems? Would that be 15 points of stress? Circulatory issues, 40 points. Bladder issues, 15 points. Concern over distant relatives, maybe 20 points. Car problems, 10 points of stress. Undone house repairs, 5 points. Real or perceived money insufficiency, 50 points. Mobility worries, can I get around tomorrow? Can I make it to the doctor? Can I walk? Some things that we never took, you know, imagine when we were young. 30 points. Security concerns, 30 points. Loneliness, for some it might be 20 points, for others it might be 70 points. Now, if loneliness is 70 points, just on the points I gave, if somebody had all of that going on at once, that'd be 360 points, and death is only 300. No, I forgot to add. Yeah, the 100 points also for a happy marriage. You could have 360, maybe 460 points pointed against oneself. Now, if Job were alive, I get the impression he would say, well, under my jurisdiction, nobody's going to have that many points stressed. They won't have even half of that much. I will do what I can. And let's take a look at that over in Job chapter 31. Job chapter 31. In verse 16. This person was a champion of those that he was in a position to help. Job 31 and verse 16 says, if I have withheld the poor from their desire, or have caused the eyes of the widow to fail, or have eaten my morsel myself alone, mine totally and exclusively on oneself, and the fatherless has nothing to eat, for if from my youth he has brought me up, brought up with me as my as with a father, and I've guided her through my mother's womb, if I have seen any perish for want of clothing, or the poor without covering, if his loins have not blessed me, and if he were not warmed with the fleece of my sheep, if I have lifted up my hand against the fatherless when I saw my help in the gate, then let my arm fall off of my shoulder. Let my arm be broken from the bone. And for destruction from God was a terror to me, and by reason of his highness I could not endure. He says, I can't live with myself if I am totally oblivious to what's right in front of my eyes. So he really had compassion. David Lloyd George made the observation. He was the Prime Minister of Britain. He says, the truest test of any civilization is the way it treats its elderly people. I won't turn there, but in Exodus 22, verse 22, says, through Moses, God warned the Israelites not to neglect the widows. Deuteronomy 24, verse 17, I'll just refer to that. You could actually take somebody's pledge as collateral if they owed you money. Somebody's garment is a pledge. But even with that principle, you were not allowed back then to take a widow's garment as collateral. So we will look at some other aspects here and show that it is possible to have these circumstances and to transform what is called an affliction in the Bible to absolute joy, where people can sing and they can be excited. And I believe that Job was right, that he made the widow's hearts sing for joy. In 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 5, in 1 Timothy 5 and verse 5, before going on to talking about what can be done, it's important for us to really analyze this from the inside out, to really appreciate the circumstances involved. There were times in the writing of the Apostle Paul that there were people that were disadvantaged and they had no physical means of support and they had no relatives. And as he said in 1 Timothy 5 and verse 5, "Now she that is a widow indeed and desolate trusts in God and continues in supplication and prayer night and day." And that is and emphasizing the fact that when somebody seems to be alone, in a sense, that they have that recourse and God will hear. He is very concerned about, well, all people, the people in difficult circumstances that can't always do for themselves. And if we all live long enough, even though we probably don't think about it, if we live long enough, we're in the same circumstance. That God is obligating Himself to respond to people that need help and that He will help them. Miraculously, whatever it takes, He will help them. I remember reading of another person who wrote, she said, "I never knew about the bills after the death of my spouse. We had an adjustable rate mortgage and credit card debts for hospital bills that I didn't even know about. I didn't realize that I had ruined credit. My friends changed along with my status as a person. I was no longer a married lady. I was suddenly single in a world of couples. No one around to guarantee what I could do to help myself. And when it said, 'Till death do us part,' I thought it would be at least 50 years off into the future somewhere." I'd like for us at this point to turn to a story that seemed to be that sad, and yet it had a very happy ending. And that's over in the book of Ruth. In the book of Ruth, we read about a famous widow who had like interests, just like us, who had emotions and feelings, just as we do, and had a major challenge. I'll get over there. Ruth, chapter 1 and verse 8. If you remember the story of Ruth, Ruth and her sister married were Moabites that married men from Israel. And the two men had a mother by the name of Naomi. And so it turned out that there was a terrible famine in Israel, and it was that Naomi and her husband had chosen to move where they could survive. They moved over to Moab. And in the course of time, their sons married two Moabites. So in chapter 1 and verse 8, "And Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, 'Go now,'" this was when not only Naomi's husband died, but Naomi's two sons also died. That was a bitter blow, because back then, if you lost a mate, at least you had offspring. You had sons, hopefully, that could look out for you and help you. And that was like the last line of resort, and that's still true in so many nations today. Verse 8, "Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, 'Go, return each to her mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you as you've dealt with your husbands, the dead, and my husband, and with me.'" She felt obligated to do that. By doing that, she was saying, "Now, if you do, and you go back, which I'm asking you to do, that leaves me all alone." Of course, she had no means of support. She didn't have any energy. She didn't have great health or avenues of employment. You know, there was no safety net. And so she was out. And she just was willing to put them first. Verse 9, the Lord grant you that you might find rest, each of you in the house of her husband. And then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voice, and they wept. It was a very sad moment for all three of them. And they said to her, surely we will return with you to your people. And Naomi said, turn away, my daughters, for why would you go with me? Are there any more sons, in my womb that they could be your husbands later? And even if I could give birth to children, you'd have to wait another couple decades before they'd be old enough to marry you. And so she was very, very distraught. Understandably so. To say how could one feel that negative would be very insensitive. Most of us have never been there. So verse 14, they lifted up their voices, they wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clave unto her. So one of the sisters decided, well, yeah, it really isn't convenient. It doesn't work out here. I got a life to live, and I'm young, and I feel sick at heart for my mother-in-law. But I'm willing to, follow her advice. It makes sense on paper. I'm going to go back. Ruth put heart before head. She said, love transcends all. I'm going to stay with you. I will not leave you. Which was very noble. And Ruth pleaded with her, don't let me leave. Don't, please. And Naomi said, And then they did go together to Bethlehem, which was very, very dangerous. They had to probably take the same road that Christ mentioned about where the Good Samaritan is mentioned for rescuing several people that were wounded by robbers. Two women traveling alone was incredibly dangerous. Yet they made it back to Bethlehem, just below Jerusalem. And when the people surrounded them, they started to remember, oh yeah, you used to live here. And what's your name? In verse 20, she said to them, call me not Naomi, but call me Mara, for the Lord has dealt bitterly with me. And that was her perspective. Now, was the Lord dealing bitterly with her? No, but that was her perception. And perceptions can be realities. She probably was thinking, on my stress level is probably 400 points. I've lost one daughter-in-law. I've lost a husband. I've lost my two sons. I have no money. I don't know where we're going to live for sure. Maybe there's some kind of inheritance. Maybe we have a distant relative that could help us out. I hate to ask for anything. I don't feel energetic. I don't know where the next meal's coming from. I'm bitter. I am bitter. And people can get locked into that. Very, very difficult. I'll make reference to 2 Kings 4, verses 1 and 2, where Elijah was able to multiply a widow's oil to become financially solvent. But she was in a situation where she'd lost her husband, but she had two sons. But they were in debt, and the creditors were hounding them. And the creditors said, well, we will take the two sons. They'll be slaves. Then the debt will be paid. And she's thinking, okay, then I have no money. I have lost my two sons. I have no means of support. I'll die. That's what people looked at. Looking at death through the barrel of a gun. Not good. In Naomi's case, she was extremely bitter. And there was a snowballing negativity. You'll read in the New Testament and other places like the Syrophoenician woman and the woman who was bleeding that touched Christ. There were a number of people that were widows, and they were survivors. They would be persistent. They would get the attention of people. But not everybody has that personality. There may have been others that were more quiet that perished. There was no safety net, no Social Security, no Medicaid, no Medicare, no Obamacare, food stamps or earned income credit or Section 8 or AmeriCorps, tax refunds or government loans. Nothing for them to do except beg on the streets with the beggars and the cripples and the lepers. People that in some cases could make a lot more noise. But the ones that are mentioned were survivors. Anna, and others that had a relationship with Christ. They were survivors or fighters or very converted people. But to get out of the snowballing negativity for Naomi, she decided, she realized finally, once she got on the scene, that Boaz, a prominent person, was a distant relative. And she steered Ruth in his direction, and we don't have time to go through the fascinating story of what happened. But at the end, Ruth and Boaz get married, and Boaz was very kind, and he looked out for Naomi. And what was beautiful about that was that Naomi became a grandmother to Obed, the child that was born to Ruth and Boaz. And suddenly, she's part of a family. She's integrated in society. She has financial security. She has a future. She has people. She has relationships. And so a lot of these other problems just melted away. And she went from 400 and 300 points of stress down to maybe 50 or 30. That's the way life should be. And you read the rest of the chapter 4 of the book of Ruth, and you realize that she became happy. Happier than she had been in decades. It was a wonderful, wonderful conclusion. Life, again, was worth living. She was in very much ensconced in a family situation. That's what can happen. How do you get out of snowballing negativity? And it can be all-encompassing. You know, our perceptions can be our realities. And just to underscore how very powerful that can be, in the 1800s, in the French Foreign Legion, one captain decided to run an experiment. He took one of their prisoners, and they laid him down. Had his men laid the guy down on a cot, faced up. They took his arms and extended them outwardly, resting on chairs. And they took a couple buckets of ice, and they put the ice on his wrist, which deadened the sensitivity of the skin. And they had him blindfolded. And the ice that remained on the wrist would melt, and you'd hear this drip, drip into the buckets. And he thought that they were killing him, because they took a rubber knife that couldn't cut anything and ran it across his wrist. And he's like this. And he would hear the drip, drip. And he thought it was his own blood. And he thought, it's over. It's over. In 10 minutes after they did that, he died. He died. Mind over matter. I'm not up on all the intricacies of that concept. But, you know, people can believe certain things that are not true, and that can have a powerful effect. If I believe that I'm down and out, that I have no friends, I have no future, I have no recourse, I have no whatever, I could say, call me bitter. Call me bitter. Naomi, by the grace of God, was taken out of that. Naomi's heart sang for joy. Now Anna, in the book of Luke, her heart sang for joy. But she had an extraordinary relationship with God. She served God with fastings and prayer frequently, even in advanced age. But a lot of times God will intervene with different answers to prayer. But a lot of it revolves around what God can do through the rest of us. This gets into the aspect of what can we do to enable widows' hearts to sing for joy. I have 6 points here. One is direct care, and that could be emotional or physical. Emotionally, it's important. Sometimes when people are in need or feel a void, feel empty, remind them and ourselves of the greatness of God. The fact that God hears us, that God has promises, they are there to be claimed. And sometimes just persistence to get the results that we need. Physically, we have a number of people that are constantly looking out for the welfare of others. Can we do a better job? I'm sure. And we'll never have enough people. But I really am amazed and impressed, and I hate to, like, I'm the judge of it. I'm not. God is. But I'm thankful that people take a great interest in the lives of other people here. And Jesus Christ looked out for his mother. He had John, the apostle, take care of her in the years after Christ's death. I've seen people even in this congregation set an extraordinary example. Can remember when Lillian Sirks, who had nothing, no house, nothing, and again, up through her 90s, medical condition, she was so heavy she couldn't hardly move. And yet she had the nickname Party Animal because she was so friendly to people and they took an interest in her. And we had a couple that decided, well, why don't we provide her a place to live, which they did. And her heart sang for joy. It sang for joy. I know it did. She was constantly jovial, happy. We have a family in South Florida. Mother is in a coma in a hospital. It's been that way for almost 2 years. And the family is there night and day around the clock and have been virtually the entire time. I don't know if Mom can even be aware that they are there, but you talk about honoring someone. They certainly set an example like that. Sometimes somebody could call and say, you know, I don't have endless time maybe, but I'm free on some Mondays. And I'd be happy to come repair a few things around the house or take a look at the car, if you wish. There was one man that we have that was an auto dealer, and people would give him money. Widows had saved up to buy them cars. He says, I'd be so nervous, I'd be sweating bullets in prayer. Please, don't let me buy a lemon. I'm going to go out there, I'm going to try to find the best car I can. And he would do that time and time again for various widows. Sometimes it makes sense to have a car, sometimes it doesn't make sense. Third tithe is, of course, a way that people can always donate to, but because many of us are increasingly taxed to fund public government assistance and other programs, the church has over time decreed that paying additional funding in this area is not necessarily mandatory. Maybe that's something to counsel about. But God, one thing that is obvious is that God requires loving involvement with the older generation. And that will involve some time. Leads me up to a second area, and that's visiting. And by the way, the church is obligated, just as in 1 Timothy 5, to help those that are truly in need. We'll never have all the money to help everybody that comes down the street, maybe, that asks. We have to be careful that they're not just going to run and buy drugs and alcohol with what you give them. Makes wisdom and discernment. But certainly the church has set an example of trying to look out for people. Secondly is visiting. We can never visit enough. We are saying when we show up, we are including you in our lives. You're part of our extended family. We had the opportunity to see one of our widows who's in her new nursing home, and she was happy and excited. She says, why, I've had people come by here all day. She says, I figured it out. She says, 11 people. Now, that's not the sign of righteousness if you have 11 and somebody else has 13 people show up. But still, it just, maybe the luck of the draw, just happened that way that everybody converged that day. But she felt appreciated and loved. Her heart was singing for joy. And what is life if it's not with people? You know, it says it's not good for man to be alone. It's not good for male people to be alone all the time. But for women, they are naturally communicators, naturally more relationship-oriented. And they appreciate being part of the greater whole. And we can do a lot to make that happen. I am impressed in this congregation that we have more than a few that have adopted various people. I won't read names because I don't want to embarrass anybody. But I think that's a great honor to be adopted or to have people come by. There are people that have had deep emotional hurts and unresolved problems. Maybe some of those can be talked through with the ministry. But, you know, in general, just a caring, an adult, work, teenager or somebody that genuinely is interested, genuinely cares, can make a huge impact. Life shouldn't be alone. Sometimes you may not know what to say. Let the other person say. Maybe the most difficult time for me was when a person's husband had died just a few minutes before I got there. And there were a number of us sitting in the living room. And just to hold the widow's hand and not say anything for a half an hour, that was the right thing to do, it seemed like. And after that, then I said, well, maybe I better make a few phone calls, get the ball rolling. Hospitality, a third area. Hospitality, year-round. Picking people up, bringing them over, taking people out to restaurant or movie, art show, some outing where it would be of interest to that person. Maybe you clear it with the nursing home. Maybe you borrow a wheelchair. Plan something in the daytime if night is too late. Bring somebody to a Bible study or to another church area on a visit. Meet new people. Some can travel all day. Others may not be able to travel hardly at all. It's different. We have an elder who says, in West Texas where I work, everybody's scattered. So what I'll do is I'll drive 20 miles with my wife, pick up the first widow, and then we'll drive another 20 miles and meet with somebody else. And just include as many people as possible. A group of young adults could call up a senior and say, well, several of us would like to come over soon or maybe next Sunday and bring ice cream. Oh, you're diabetic? We'll bring lasagna and wine. We'll spend time. We'll bring some cards. Or we'll play this Bible game. Or how about Monopoly with real money? or let's go to watch some event together. Tailored to their interests. Hospitality, and certainly a fourth area, hospitality at the Feast of Tabernacles, where we have discretionary time, where we have some money, where we certainly can make an effort. Now, I remember one pastor I met in Squaw Valley. I was a student, college was up there, and he was making the rounds from one dwelling place to the next, checking up on his people. But he did it, as I watched him talking to people, you could tell he was sincerely interested. He wasn't just getting in his quota. I think I'd be insulted if somebody went up to me and said, well, how are you doing? How are you doing? Okay, all right. Well, I got that one done. So that did happen one time. That I found amusing, but you don't, it has to be from the heart. And if for some weird reason you're not sure you've got it, ask God for it. It's amazing what some people have done. We had a couple here in this congregation one time that took a woman who had never been out of the county practically, flew her to Pasadena with them for the whole Feast of Tabernacles. We've had others that took people to Europe. That's not something the average person's probably going to be able to do. And I'm not implying that you should. But those things have happened. Those things have happened. Making a difference for others. And that's what is important. Life is with people. The fifth area, and I could maybe spend all day on just the previous points. Ask for the help of some of these people. It has to be sincere. That people like to be needed. And when people have lived for 70, 90, 100 years, they've done a lot. They've seen a lot. They are a great resource, a great spiritual resource in some cases, and a great fund of knowledge. Ask for their help. Prayer, asking for them to pray, is extremely strategic. We had a contingent of widows in New Hampshire that were very effective that way. And they laughingly would call themselves, "We're the widow power here, the engine that runs this church." Well, with God's help, they were. I understand there was a group in Big Sandy, similar. They made a difference. You might ask for their help in other ways. Maybe to babysit. And then you come home, and then do something with her or several people. Maybe you could take any of these people to hunt for a church hall. The person that got this hall was a widower who was in his 80s, and he's gotten several halls. Help and participation in the next Kingdom of God seminar. Asking for help to cook for an activity. Or maybe giving them the funds to go do something that would be of help to us. That's significant. People want to feel needed. And they can. And everybody can make a contribution. Our lives aren't over yet. Mr. Armstrong said, "I am accomplishing more now than I did then." He had less energy, but he was thinking more carefully in trying to make each minute count. He accomplished a lot. A sixth area. Show honor to a widow's husband by talking about his positive traits when he was alive with her. You know, when somebody's lived with a person for 30, 40, 50, 60 years, that person's not going to just turn a light switch off and say, "Well, okay, this is a new phase of my life. I can't think about the past. Nothing, you know." Why? Why? Why would that even be considered? You know, you don't sweep all the memories under a rug and never conclude the person's course of conversation. I think it's healthy to. You know, we still learn from people that were among us. How do you ignore past members such as Charles Oldroyd or Pat Rigor, Bill Weber, or Wayne Phillips? Well, you don't. You know, with the resurrection right around the corner, these people will be back with us very, very quickly. And without all those aches and pains that they went through, they're almost legendary. You know, nobody dies perfect. But I imagine that God, who knew what was going on, was fine-tuning the dials and saying, "Okay, well, I see them going, there's these different challenges going on in their lives and all, but personality-wise and so forth, I think I got them where they need to be. Okay, they're temporarily dead and soon to be alive once again." Well, I'll never forget these guys. Bill Weber, yeah, he was sometimes bad with me, I'll say that. He there was this time when we had this public Bible lecture up in Spring Hill, and we had half of the building. We didn't know there was a Catholic mass that was going on in the other half. And there was a singing and so forth, and Bill would look at me and do the little cross thing. He knew that would rattle my cage. And he never got tired of doing that in years. He would do it right over there. And, you know, that was just part of the spice of life, you know, and I enjoyed that. And the first time I met Pat Rigor was over on the other side of the state. We had the last day of unleavened bread, and he had the sermon in the morning. I had it in the afternoon. And we were 10 miles away from NASA Space Center. And we come out after the first service, and the ground's shaking, and we didn't realize a shuttle was taking off. You could see it. And Pat's going around saying, "The church is canceled this afternoon. It's all over. Nothing to see here, folks. Time to go home." Why? "Oh, Mr. Veller, he abandoned us. He's on the shuttle. He's gone." And I thought, wow, this is interesting. And you know, every time I'd come to church, he'd tease me, say, "Braden, I'm glad to see you're here after, I guess, another successful week of roaming to and fro in the earth," quoting the book of Job. You know, I loved it. And these guys, one day, not too long from now, they're going to walk in on us, in a sense, and they're going to say, "We're back." And I think that's going to be a real thrill. And I have people that are legends, in a sense, people that have done things. Well, Mr. Oldroyd was part of our setup crew until he was 95, and then we pulled him away from that. You know, these are jewels, and these people will be part of the Kingdom of God. They'll be part of our family once again. We'll be able to share again with these people. Why would we pretend that they weren't around. Not that we are trying to do, but I mean, it's healthy to talk about these things from time to time. It's worth it to remind ourselves that we are a family and that everybody is entitled to be a part of it. You know, if you want to be in, you're in. And it means a lot. That's why it says over in Matthew 19, at the end of that chapter, that when we come into this way of life, we have friends 100-fold. There is a family that is so much larger. I know that my family, who had never been in the church, my physical family, could not understand how I could know so many people so well, all over the country. Just go anywhere, any city, and run into people that I knew, or they were good friends of people that I knew. There is nothing else like this in society. It is what happens when you are a part of a family that is international, that is founded on Christian principle. It's not perfect, but it's wonderful. And when we are involved with each other, and everybody's a part of the larger whole, people's hearts sing for joy. When they are valued, when they are important, when they are connected, when they are appreciated and honored, revered, they are part of a precious family, and there's great meaning, and there are no age limits. There are no sex differentiations. I mean, everybody, regardless of background, can be a part of that. That's what God's Holy Spirit can do. So in retrospect, as we look at this, we can appreciate what James was talking about. The people, through various setbacks and through seemingly physical disadvantages, can be in what is described in the King James language as affliction. Affliction. And the rest of us ought to be sensitive to that, respectful to that. In comparison to what other people live for, to win chess games, to win the New Jersey Lotto, and so forth, our purpose is so much infinitely higher than that. We can bring a higher degree of respect, honor, and happiness to the lives of other needy people and emulate, in doing so, people like Job or Jesus Christ or Elisha or James. Why not? With the time that we have, open ourselves up to the lives of other people and make their lives even more significant and more valuable than they are already. Our lives are not complete unless we follow the example of Job and make the widow's hearts sing for joy.